Spectator is having a flash sale. Get 12 issues of the magazine for just £12, in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label Whiskey, completely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/sale. Be quick, the offer ends on Monday.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Coffee House Shots. I'm James Slife and I'm joined by Katie Balls. On the day that the government has outlined the new tier system that England will be in when lockdown ends on the 2nd of December. The system is much stricter than what went before. More than 98% of the country will be in either tier one or tier two. Katie, how are these new restrictions going down with Tory MPs?
Not very well. I think that you saw yesterday evening Boris Johnson address the 22 so Tory MPs, and his message was ultimately, you know, this is going to be quite difficult. We're really trying not to make these tiers any worse than they have to be, but let me be frank with you, they're pretty bad. But I still think there is a hope, even if it was a fading hope amongst lots of Conservative MPs, that their constituency would be okay. You know, there might be loads of constituents going into tier three or going into a higher level than before lockdown, but hopefully they would be okay. I think the fact that you only have three areas in tier one tells you how stark it is. So if you live in Cornwall, the Isle of Wight or the Isles of Scilly, then you are suddenly in a place where you can mix indoors in a group of six. But if you're anywhere else in England, that's not happening. And I think that there are a few ways it's manifesting itself in Tory MPs thinking this is unjust, unfair. One is, I think, quite interesting. We've heard plenty about MPs representing seats in the north who have felt there's too much of a divide and the south are doing well, but now we're seeing quite a few MPs who had constituencies that were in tier one have just been put under a 4-week national lockdown and now in tier two. I think Kent's probably the most extreme example.
It's gone from one to three,
and that's in part because actually there's a big difference depending on the various parts of Kent you are in between bad cases and actually relatively low on the other side. But the issue is they all seem obviously feeding into the hospitals in the area, so decision is made that the whole area should be in tier three, but that's not landing well. And I think also, you know, if you look at Suffolk, if you look at Matt Hancock's own seat, which is now tier two, obviously he is going along with that. But I think there's this general sense that what you're hearing a lot is, how can you go in lockdown for 4 weeks and things be worse in terms of what your constituent sees when you come out of it? Now there is an argument back to this, which is ultimately, they need to keep things under control before Christmas when things are relaxed. And I think that is in part incentivizing things to be tougher. You also have the scientific advisors who have said for quite some time that the tier system itself is not strict enough. So it's in response to that. But I think that is making it wear particularly badly. And then clearly MPs, you know, Manchester MPs who have had to deal with severe restrictions for so long now are getting pretty fed up. They're still in tier three. And I think you're seeing that with figures like Graham Brady. So I think there are plenty of Tory MPs from both sides, if you look at those two reasons, who are questioning whether or not they're going to vote for this. But will it make any difference, James?
So the place which has changed is a place which is famous for not having Tory MPs, Liverpool. That's gone from tier three to tier two. And I suspect that the government are going to be talking a lot about Liverpool at Boris Johnson's press conference later on. And that's because they would say, look, Liverpool shows they got the mass testing unit in, the city cooperated with that, and that has helped to bring down the cases. Now, this is an odd discussion we're having in a way, because unlike with previous lockdowns, we now have some idea of how this ends. You know, it is now a kind of broad expectation that these restrictions will fall away in April because of the Oxford vaccine news. Although there have been some questions raised about the Oxford vaccine, but I think the broad expectation is still that. But the question is, what can mass testing? I think the argument you're hearing from the government is everywhere in tier three will be offered mass testing and this will help these places get out of that. Is that going to be enough for Tory MPs, Katie Balls?
I don't think it's going to be enough to stop them being annoyed. I think the question is, what are they going to do about it? I think the promise of mass testing and a vaccine is a light at the end of the tunnel to a degree. But I think we saw it on Monday. The Prime Minister thought he had lots of good news to announce, you know, vaccine progress, the end of the national lockdown. But yet all the questions were about the fact that he had just slipped into this, that there was going to be a tier system up until at minimum the spring. So I think there is a difference of opinion or how you look at things between the government, which see, oh, good news, everyone is going to hunker down because they can see good news is coming, and Tory MPs who say, well, this is actually a really long time, lots of businesses are not going to cope, and also there are lots of other issues in terms of loneliness to take into account. And I don't think that that's quite been levelled with yet in terms of how you deal with it. And I also think part of the issue is there is actually just a lack of trust that Boris Johnson actually will end things when he says. So you can talk about the spring, but I mean, we could spend this podcast listing the various times Boris Johnson suggested things would go back to close to normal. Now, I don't think that in retrospect, he was particularly, you can understand why he said the things he did at the time. I think that a pandemic poses, you know, unique, very difficult circumstances. I can see why he did say we can turn the tide in 12 weeks. You could argue in a way the tide was turned in terms of the stem of infections. But I think saying things like that early on, I think talking about getting, you know, back to normal near Christmas, I don't think the Christmas bubble counts, in my opinion, I think has just led to this sense that the concern amongst Tory MPs is not just that they're being asked to go through this for several months. It's that the goalposts could be moved again.
And in other news today,
And James, I think one thing I keep hearing is this OBR report and how it's fueling concerns. Are you picking up on that?
Yeah, I think the fact, yeah, now there's a slight irony here, which is the OBR report came out before the Oxford vaccine news. But I think the problem, exactly as you alighted on, Katie, is that people have heard too much optimistic talk from Downing Street that hasn't come to fruition. And so when they see an OBR report suggesting that the vaccine won't really get going until the summer, people become sceptical. Now, Katie, the other news today that you've written about is the appointment of a new Downing Street Chief of Staff. Who is it and what do we need to know?
Yes, so we have a new Chief of Staff. It's Dan Rosenfeld, and he is a former Treasury civil servant, a very senior one, who served under two chancellors in Alistair Darling and George Osborne. The appointment is interesting for a few reasons. As I touched on in last week's cover piece, Boris Johnson has been quite keen to fill it quickly. It wasn't just that, obviously, depending on who you get, they have a long notice period. I think there was a sense that given the drama that led to the point where he lost his director of communications, Lee Kane, Dominic Cummings left, and that stemmed from when he was going to give Lee Kane the chief of staff appointment, and there was a backlash. I think there was a sense that he wanted to show, you know, there isn't drift, there isn't a vacuum, we're going to move quickly on this. In terms of what the appointment tells us, I think what's really striking is in a way how unpolitical it is. So it's a former civil servant, someone who, well, just go on Twitter, there's lots of people who want to give him lots of praise, always take any promotional praise with a slight pinch of salt, because people probably want to have someone who picks up their phone calls. But generally speaking, the feedback seems to be quite positive on this person from those who previously worked with him. But yes, former civil servant, and I don't think you could say they're, you know, a well-known name in Tory circles. I think some have suggested that, you know, had they thought this person had any political leaning, it's probably more centrist, Blair Labour kind of positioning than to the right. And I think you can't tie this person to a certain faction. So when we're talking about the grand reset, even if people don't use the word reset anymore, often people said, look at the chief of staff appointment, because if that links to a Tory faction, it is going to tell you, you know, who Boris Johnson is listening to more. I don't think this tells you that. Ultimately, it tells you that when it comes to what he wants this appointment to do, it isn't so much a political direction as trying to get what his political vision already, you know, done, get actions done. So I think that is interesting. I do think we now have a situation, though, where you have Simon Case, who is the cabinet secretary. You have the new chief of staff, a former senior civil servant in the Treasury. And therefore, where is the political direction coming from? Now, it may be coming from roles that are already there, the prime minister himself. One of the big criticisms of Lee Kane as chief of staff was that he'd be too divisive, and there was already a damaged relationship in terms of the chief, you know, between him and MPs and the chief of staff. It had to be very acutely aware of what the Tory party wanted. So it does make you wonder, while this person by no means anyone suggesting is divisive, clearly is not a well-known name in the Tory party, are they going to bring in someone else who's also going to really work on the party management side? Or do you think this person's going to quite quickly be able to, learn the ropes in that sense? What do you think, James?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is Dan Rosenfeld will become chief of staff on the 1st of January. So, it's a good job for him. But, you know, the New Year's Eve will not quite be the usual shebang this year because it's his first day in his new job. But on years. But I think what's interesting is we had thought that Eddie Lister would be leaving Downing Street in the new year. Instead, it suggests after Eddie Lister hands over the role of chief of staff to Dan Rensselaer, he will stay on to support both the new chief of staff and the prime minister, which does make me wonder whether Eddie Lister will take on kind of more of the role of communicating what, you know, Eddie Lister has long been regarded as the, one of the most diplomatic figures in Number 10. And you wonder whether he is going to take on more of the role of reporting back, you know, what Tory MPs are thinking about. You know, one thing I've always thought was a kind of slight problem for Boris Johnson was that he didn't have many spare stomachs, by which I mean the Prime Minister's time is obviously a precious commodity in any Downing Street. But, you know, sometimes you need, you know, senior backbenchers need to be able to have supper with someone and feel that it's almost as good as having supper with the Prime Minister. The Downing Street up to now has struggled with people who are the natural type of people to send off to have supper with the chairman of a select committee or something like that. Eddie Lister is quite a natural person to fill that role.
And we've also got the news that Cleo Watson is leaving 10 Downing Street. She is a former Vote Leaver and a close ally of Dominic Cummings. So, James, do you think what we're seeing then in the arrival of Dan Rosenfield and the exit of another of what was seen as, you know, the Vote Leave tribe in Downing Street is a big change in, you know, who the key players are and perhaps the tone going forward?
Cleo Watson was obviously a very close ally of Dominic Cummings. You know, they in those innumerable clips taken outside Dominic Cummings' house, Cleo Watson would be in the taxi picking him up on the way to work. And obviously, you know, there has been a kind of a shift, a change in Downing Street. But I think the thing on the Dan Rosenfield thing, to come back to your point about political direction, I think it's a sign that Boris Johnson is basically saying, we've got enough vision. What we need is more implementation. And I think this is something that he does feel, which is he has lots of ideas about his conference speech was all about how he wanted Britain to look in 2030. Now, these were it was a very Boris Johnson kind of column of a speech, if you see what I mean. The Britain in 2030 was kind of, you know, it was a big picture. I think he went past some restored woodland and revived, reintroduced animal species.
Yeah. And some suggest that perhaps he was ignoring the immediate coronavirus problem in doing so. But
I think what he's trying to say is, I've got all these ideas about what I want this country to look like at the end of my premiership. I now want people to pull the levers and make this happen for me. And I think he tried a kind of attempt to rewire Whitehall, right? This is less of an attempt, I think, to rewire Whitehall and more of an attempt to say, let's put the people who know how the wiring works best. If I was kind of looking for an analogy, this sometimes 10 Downing Street is an old house. Sometimes in an old house, the electric wiring makes almost no sense. And an electrician would look at it and think, oh my God, you should pull all that out and start again. But the problem with trying to rewire something is you basically have to move out for 6 months while it happens. What Boris Johnson is saying is, I'm not going to try and rewire the house, but I'm going to get the people in who know precisely how to make this current odd set of wiring work. I think that is the decision that he is taking here.
So I suppose to summarise, are you suggesting that we're going to be seeing almost a change of tack from Boris Johnson from the beginning, where we knew Dominic Cummings was trying to rewire government, change how it works, you know, all of that, to actually saying, well, you know what, let's just work with what we got and go to the people first? Almost full circle, or am I going too far?
I think that Boris Johnson has always held these two ideas about government in his head, which is, I remember when he went to the Foreign Office. He went to the Foreign Office and lots of people said, oh, you know, Foreign Office is full of Europhiles and you've got to kind of shake it up and all this. Boris Johnson used to eat lunch in the staff canteen every day at the Foreign Office and kind of was very key and would come out of all of these every lunchtime and come back saying, I've just met the most brilliant person, blah, 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 blah. And so he has always had, as on so many issues, he said he doesn't have a kind of one simple view on this question about Whitehall. He kind of thinks there are brilliant people, he thinks there are things that don't work. I think this is more him saying, let's take the kind of, he has assembled in Dan Rosenfield, Simon Case, James Bowler, what I think anyone would objectively say were three of the most talented civil servants of their generation. And he is essentially saying to them, right, can you make this machine work for me?
Thank you, James.
And thank you, Katie.
And thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow.